That's not what I meant. The Sociolinguistics of Everyday Conversation, Lecture 4, Power and Solidarity, The Interplay of Hierarchy and Connection.
In this lecture, we're going to look behind language, you might say, to consider the human dynamics that drive our uses of language. I'm going to introduce a concept that linguists refer to as power and solidarity. And this is the last concept that we're going to need to consider to get a handle on all the processes that go on in any interaction. And then future lectures will look at all the specific interactions and specific linguistic rituals and how they work. So this one is the last one laying the groundwork for how we can think about conversational style and interaction. Anytime we talk to another person, we negotiate two dynamics. On one hand, we're concerned with how close or distant we're going to be to each other. In other words, how connected we want to be. But we also negotiate who has more power in the situation. If two people want to stand on the same spot, who will step aside? If they try standing on the same spot, who's going to get stepped on? People who study language have written about these simultaneous but conflicting human needs as power and solidarity. The first one to write about this dynamic and its effect on language were a pair of psychologists, Roger Brown and Albert Gilman. Way back in 1960, they wrote an article entitled "The Pronouns of Power and Solidarity." They focused on pronouns. They looked at languages in which a speaker has to make a choice between a formal and an informal pronoun. So if you know French, Italian, many Romance languages have this. In Spanish, the informal would be tú, the formal would be usted. Now, English is not a language that has the formal and informal anymore. We did it one time. But you can see a parallel in English with first name versus title, last name. So, for example, power would be a situation where one person gets title, last name, and the other one gets first name. So a teacher refers to a student as Johnny. The Johnny calls the teacher Miss Gray. There may be many other situations where you'll see that power difference. So, for example, a lawyer might address the elevator operator in a building that has elevator operators by first name and be addressed by Mr. So-and-so or Ms. So-and-so. So power obtains when one person gets the formal form of address and the other one gets the informal, and it's asymmetrical. It's not reciprocal. Solidarity can either be first name or title, last name, or the formal pronouns or the informal pronouns, so long as it's mutual or reciprocal. So in other words, if you both call each other by first name, that's solidarity. If you both call each other by title, last name, that's solidarity. So power comes in where it's asymmetrical and solidarity comes in where it's mutual. In my own writing, I often use the words status and hierarchy for the power dimension, and I use the words connection or involvement for the solidarity dimension. And so I'll be using these words sort of interchangeably. So power, status, hierarchy on the one hand, connection, involvement, solidarity on the other. Now, in their original article, Brown and Gilman tended to talk about power and solidarity as two different dynamics, and that you were either in a situation of power or in a situation of solidarity. It seems to me that power and solidarity are always at play, and they entail each other. And this is what's really interesting. Solidarity is when you feel connected or close to someone, but it entails a kind of power. If you're close to someone, you have to take into account the effect of what you do on them. So that gives them a kind of power over what you do. So in other words, if you live alone and you're entirely independent, you can come and go as you please. You're completely free. If you live with someone, you have to take into account the effect of what you do on them. So, for example, if you're going to be late for dinner, maybe you have to call them and tell them you're going to be late for dinner because what you do affects them. One way of thinking about that is that it gives them a kind of power over you because you aren't as completely free as you would be if you didn't have that closeness. At the same time, power entails a kind of solidarity. If you're in hierarchical relation to someone, it actually means you're involved with each other. being uninvolved, having no connection, no closeness, would probably be more likely to happen with someone you have only a formal relationship with. And in fact, when you think about it, perhaps the closest relationship is also the most hierarchical, and that would be a parent-child relationship. You find the most power difference, but it's also the closest. So solidarity entails power, and power entails solidarity. So these are the dynamics that become really interesting when we look at how people use language to talk to each other. And if we ask ourselves, why are we talking in the way we are, you can answer in terms of connection and status or hierarchical relations. In other words, you're talking the way you are to balance and find the right balance for this relationship in this context, the power relationships and the solidarity. So let me give you a couple of examples. A man named Jack. I'm giving him the name Jack, but this was a true anecdote, commented to me that he had been visiting his grandmother in the nursing home, and she had commented to him, feeling very good about it. She said she's really in with the nurses at her nursing home because they call her Millie. And it made him a little uncomfortable because he thought that they were showing insufficient respect for her age. So she was taking the use of her first name by the nurses in the spirit of solidarity. We're close, so they call me by first name. He was looking at it from the perspective of hierarchy, insufficient respect for her age. Here's another one. I was actually walking on a college campus with a colleague, and one of our more senior colleagues came by, and it was a brisk fall day, a little bit chilly, and we were all going to the same meeting, so we fell in together and walked together, and the woman that I was with turned to the guy and said, where's your coat? And he said, thanks, Mom. And she was kind of felt put down by that and felt uncomfortable. She had asked, where's your coat, in a friendly spirit, you might say the spirit of solidarity. By saying, thanks, Mom, he was reinterpreting it from the perspective of power or hierarchy. In other words, asking me where my coat is like a mother asking a child why he isn't wearing a coat. You're putting yourself in a one-up position. You're putting me in a one-down position. So that's power. It's interesting, too, because he interpreted it in terms of power. His response made her feel put down. So he answered, you might say, in a spirit of power. Almost any interaction can be interpreted from these two different perspectives. So here's another one. A man came home and commented to his wife that his rival was editing a book and asked him to contribute a chapter. And his wife said, hey, that's really great. You know, maybe he's trying to patch things up, you know, a rapprochement here. And he said, honey, he's the editor. I'm the contributor. He's trying to get me under his thumb. So which is it? Is it power? He's the editor. I'm a contributor. He's up, I'm down. Or is it connection? He's having me be part of a project that he's participating in. I don't think in any of these you can definitively say it's this or it's that, because power and solidarity always are at play in any interaction. And that's, to me, what's so fascinating, kind of trying to pull apart these different things. Women are more often addressed by first name than men. This is something that we know happens. So it's not unusual for me to be on a panel with my male colleagues, and they may be addressed as Professor or Dr. So-and-so, and I may be addressed as Deborah. I had mentioned professional situations, so often doctors are called Dr. Smith, Dr. Brown, and they may address their patients by first name. Does this show friendliness or does it show lack of respect? I know many women who resent being addressed by first name and because they take it as insufficient respect. They feel they're not getting as much respect as the men are getting. But it's possible that people simply feel they're more approachable, feel friendlier to them. It's much more common for women in public life to be addressed by first name. Remember, Hillary was always Hillary, just her first name. I didn't even have to say her last name. You know who that refers to. Very interesting. The interplay of power and solidarity becomes very interesting when you think about doctor-patient communication. So many professional women that I have talked to really resent the fact that their doctors, especially if the women have PhDs and so technically get the title doctor, even though it doesn't mean they're physicians, really resent when physicians they go to expect to be addressed by Dr. So-and-so and yet call them by first name. In one study that I did, I interviewed doctors, and I was really curious how aware doctors were of this. And I wondered whether women doctors might be more aware of this and less likely to address patients by first name. Well, I interviewed a large number of ophthalmologists, male and female doctors, and most of them told me that they were quite aware that patients preferred being addressed, many patients preferred being addressed by title last name, and that they tended to use last name unless they were calling the patient out of anesthesia, and then they might address them by first name because they thought people react more automatically to that. But very interesting that I didn't expect is a large number of the women ophthalmologists told me that they resented being addressed by first name by patients. So women physicians felt that they were more often addressed by first name by patients than men physicians were. Again, it leaves open the question about whether the reason for first name is about respect or about closeness. So my mother, for example, and my parents are in their 90s. When they were in their 80s, my mother commented that one doctor they went to was addressing my father by his first name, and she didn't like that. She thought that wasn't appropriate. My father's a retired attorney, and she thought he deserved more respect. And yet, in another conversation, I asked her whether she minded doctors addressing her by first name, and she said no. And I said, would you rather they call you Mrs. Tannen? And she said, no, that would seem a little cold. So it was interesting to me that she thought my father should get the respect of his title. She didn't feel she needed to. When it came to my father, she was interpreting it in terms of the power dynamic or respect. When it came to herself, she was approaching it from the closeness, distance dimension. I point out power and solidarity are not situated along a single continuum, but it's really a multidimensional grid. So picture a grid with two axes. There's a horizontal axis that runs between poles of connection on one end and distance on the other. In other words, how close or distant are you going to be? And then picture a vertical axis that runs between the poles of hierarchy and equality. So you might think of a very hierarchical relationship at the top and equality at the bottom. So any specific conversational move or any relationship can be placed somewhere on this grid. So a relationship might be hierarchical and close. And so parent-child, grandparent-child would be a good example of that. It might be hierarchical and distant. So maybe I suppose we could think about an employer-employee relationship. You're not friends. It's very hierarchical, but you're not close. You could think of a relationship being equal and distant. So, you know, perhaps a colleague's at the same rank. You're equals, but you're not really close to each other. And something could be equal and close, and maybe best friends would be the example of that. I think Americans often think about siblings as being equal and close. You know, you might say we're like brothers, we're like sisters, to mean we're close and we're equal. But when you think about it, sibling relationships really are not equal. They're pretty hierarchical. No matter how old you are, you know who's the older and who's the younger. There's a quote that I love from a book called Our Turn about the Delaney sisters. And so one says about the other, I know she doesn't approve of me sometimes. She looks at me in that big sister sort of way. And the speaker was 101. But her sister was 103. And the fact that the one was older and the other was younger was always there. So we can look at just about any conversational move, anything that anybody says in conversation, and ask where we would place it on that grid. One study that I did was of workplace interaction. In fact, I've written a book about that. It's called Talking from 9 to 5. There was one manager in that study who was especially effective. She was one of the highest-ranking women in that organization. She spent a lot of time going around doing small talk and befriending people. In fact, I shadowed her, and she went around just about every day, made a point of walking around her division and saying something friendly to everybody. Now, you might think this is wasting time in small talk, but the fact that everybody was her friend gave her power. If she needed to have something done, the person who had the power to do it was her friend, so she could call up and say, hi, so-and-so, and then can you do this for me? So connection entails power. if you think about international affairs, sometimes public leaders don't want to look like they're dependent on international cooperation. They think that would make them weak. But in fact, international cooperation actually strengthens rather than weakens a country. All the linguistic signals that we've been discussing can be ambiguous and polysemous, and that's a term I'll define in a second, with regard to power and solidarity, in other words, hierarchy and connection. In other words, any linguistic signal, any linguistic device, anything you say in conversation can be ambiguous with power and solidarity. In other words, it can be unclear whether what's at play is power or solidarity, like Jack's grandmother being addressed as Millie. It could be solidarity, could be power. But it also can be and often is polysemous, and that is spelled P-O-L-Y for poly, many, and S-E-M-O-U-S. S-E-M, seem, comes from the Latin word for meaning, you know, like semaphore flags that have meaning. So polysemy means multiple meanings. Anything is polysemous with regard to power and solidarity means that it means both. So I want to go down now. I want to hit a number of linguistic devices and show how they can be both ambiguous and polysemous with regard to power and solidarity. They can mean either or both. Talking along. If you talk along with someone else, they start talking and then you start talking. It could seem like an interruption, a grab for the floor. That would be power. Or it could be a show of enthusiastic listenership. That would be solidarity. It could be both. There are many people who feel that if we can enthusiastically interrupt each other, that shows we're on the same wavelength. We're really good friends. Indirectness. Some people have commented that people who have less power are more likely to be indirect. So, for example, Conley, O'Barr, and Lind did a study. They had people role play courtroom scenes, and they found that the people who had less power in the courtroom, for example, the witnesses, were more likely to be indirect. The people who had more power, for example, the judges, were more likely to be direct. Well, that's certainly true in some situations, but you can think of other situations where indirectness is the privilege of the person in power. So if you have a master and a servant, hypothetically, and the master says, "It's cold in here," the servant knows he's supposed to go and do something about it, close the window. If the servant says, "It's cold in here," he's not too likely to expect the master to go and close the window so the servant will be more comfortable. So in a way, it's the privilege of the person in power to be indirect. And you also know that lovely feeling of rapport that you get when you say something in not so many words and somebody understands it. That shows you're really close. So indirectness is ambiguous, whether the person being indirect does so because of the power or because of the connection. You speak the same language, you understand each other, or it could be both. Another would be silence versus volubility. It seems almost self-evident to many people that powerless people are silenced. You know that saying, children should be seen and not heard, because children are the less powerful in the situation. Sometimes, though, being able to be together in silence can show the deepest rapport. You're so close, you feel so comfortable, you can spend hours together and don't have to talk. So silence and volubility, too, are ambiguous. It can either mean power or it can mean connection or it can mean both at once. Finally, final example I'll give is of verbal aggression. And so shouting, arguing, criticizing, attacking verbally. Clearly, this could be aggressive. In other words, a display of power. A parent yells at a child. The child doesn't get to yell at the parent, at least ideally. Or it could be, at least in some cultures, a kind of solidarity. So there are many cultures in which being able to have a high-volume argument shows that you're sociable. In fact, in a field note, a student of mine commented that for her, a really close friendship means you can argue one good one a week is about right. So talking along, indirectness, silence versus volubility, verbal aggression are just four linguistic devices or signals that could mean either power or solidarity or could mean both at once. And we could go over all the signals that we've talked about in previous lectures or we'll talk about in future lectures and show you can interpret along these different dynamics. Sometimes frustration and confusion in conversation results from the ambiguity and polysemy of power and solidarity. Here's an actual example. A man called his wife and said, my friend from high school's in town, so I'm going to go out to dinner with him tonight. And the wife was kind of hurt by this, and she said, gee, you know, don't present it to me as an inescapable fact. If it was me, I would call and say my friend's in town, and I was thinking of having dinner with her. Would that be okay? And I know you'd say it's okay, but at least it would show that I'm not just plopping it on you. I'm kind of giving you a say in this. And he said, I can't tell my friend. I have to ask my wife for permission. So from her point of view, we're talking about connection. As I said earlier, if you're connected to a person, well, what you do affects them, so you take their feelings into account. You talk about it. You present things to them in a way that takes into account the effect of your behavior on their lives. So she was going from the connection perspective. He's going from the hierarchy perspective. The person who checks with another person is the person who's one down. Children check with their parents to find out if it's okay to do something. So that's the way he looked at it when he said, I can't tell my friend, I have to ask my wife for permission. So the dynamics of power and solidarity, or connection and status, involvement and hierarchy, help us understand the motives behind the linguistic signals, devices, and rituals that we use when we talk to each other. Now your toolkit is complete. We've got the concepts of the linguistic building blocks, of the larger processes of framing, and of the dynamics of power and solidarity that motivate our linguistic choices as we talk to each other. In the next lecture, we'll be looking at one of the most versatile conversational devices and how it functions in a whole range of communication situations, and that is indirectness.
After listening to Lecture 4, a student posed this question to Professor Tannen. Do Americans think about hierarchy and relationships in different ways than other cultures? Let's listen to the professor's response.
If you picture this grid with a vertical axis running from hierarchy to equality and a horizontal axis running from closeness to distance, it's interesting to realize that Americans tend to put relationships running from the upper right to the lower left. In other words, we tend to think of relationships as being hierarchical and distant, or close and equal. We tend to think of hierarchy as being distancing. If we're one up, one down, we can't really be close. Asian cultures tend to conceptualize relationships running from the upper left-hand quadrant to the lower right. They tend to assume that hierarchical relationships are close and equal relationships are distant. So, for example, a Japanese linguist, her name is Suwako Watanabe, did a study of small group discussions in American and Japanese among American and Japanese students. She was curious about why Japanese students studying in the United States were often very uncomfortable when the teachers broke them up into small groups and told them to work together in small groups. And she concluded that what was really uncomfortable for the Japanese students was that the hierarchy was not provided, that in Asian culture in general and Japanese culture in particular, people are comfortable when they know what the hierarchy is, and they feel united by the hierarchy. So that really took me aback when I read her study. She said, as if it were self-evident, people are united in hierarchy. It seemed to me self-evident that hierarchy is distancing and closeness is uniting. And it seemed to me almost self-evident, I thought about it, that equality is what creates closeness and that hierarchy is distancing. I said earlier that the parent-child or grandparent-child relationship is the most obviously hierarchical and also the most obviously close. Well, in Japanese culture, people seem often to have in their consciousness the sense of the parent-child relationship as the archetypal hierarchical relationship, whereas I think Americans are more likely to think of in a maybe employee-employer relationship as the archetypal hierarchical one, a kind of boss-servant situation.
This ends Lecture 4. Remember to visit this course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll find additional information about the lectures you just heard.